Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Price v. Wyeth Holdings Corporation. Mr. Kuchas.
Good morning. My name is Del Kuchas. I represent Charles Price in this appeal. Briefs have all been submitted. I know the court has read everything, so I won't spend a lot of time on the facts of the case. Essentially, there are three orders on appeal. We've got an order denying a remand, which we filed after this case was removed from state court after 11 years in which it pended. Another order springing off that one, the court, district court, having assumed jurisdiction on a diversity basis on the removal, proceeded to hear a defendant's motion to set aside a default judgment, which we had obtained in state court. That order was entered after a period of time. And then thirdly, there was a third order, defendant's motion for a dismissal on a statute of limitations question, which was also entered in defendant's favor. Threaded throughout the three orders that are on appeal are similar issues. I think as a logical starting point, I would like to address the jurisdictional issue first. If a party desiring a removal of a state court case desires to remove it to state to federal court on a federal question or a diversity jurisdiction, it must do so within a 30-day period. This was allegedly in a diversity case. One of the problems, Your Honors, is that the original complaint, which was filed in state court in this case by me, in behalf of both Kathy Price and her husband Charles, didn't include the necessary allegations of diversity of jurisdiction. Had that complaint actually been filed in a district court initially, the district court no doubt would have re-looked at it and seen that only diversity of residence was alleged, and there was no specific amount of monetary damages alleged because the Indiana rule prohibits us from doing so. And as I say, if we wished to have filed the case in a federal forum, obviously we would have had to have alleged diversity of citizenship and we would have had to have alleged some monetary damages in order for a district court to initially evaluate whether or not diversity jurisdiction obtains in the case. As the court aware and as counsel is aware, although we may like to stipulate to jurisdiction of a federal court, it is not within our province to stipulate, no matter how much we would desire to have a federal court have jurisdiction over a case. In the case at bar, the initial complaint didn't allege the necessary jurisdictional elements for diversity. Under the decisions of the Seventh Circuit and other district courts, and in particular Judge Shader in the early 90s, pleadings such as the one I filed would have been summarily sent back to a state court as not sufficient on a removal petition back then or a notice of removal as we know it today. The court has taken the position that where sufficient damages are not discernible from the pleadings themselves, a defendant who has the burden of proof that jurisdiction exists must do some other legwork before he can bring it back to a federal court.
Counsel, I thought you conceded in your briefing that this case was removable. I don't remember this argument being made, and I don't know that there is any real doubt about diversity
we have
of citizenship
to look,
here or the jurisdictional amount.
If we were to look at the analysis, Your Honor, the time frame is the initial complaint itself when it was filed.
No, the question is when it was removed. At the time it was removed, there was a default judgment for more than $75,000, and the notice of removal alleges all the citizenship details. Are you disputing the citizenship details?
No, what I'm disputing
in the notice of removal?
What we're disputing is that the case was pending in the state court for 11 years without
That's
it having been removed.
This question. It doesn't have anything to do with jurisdiction.
All right. Moving forward then, the question then becomes whether the defendants complied with the appropriate 30-day period of Section 1446B. As the court knows, there's two 30-day periods. One applies when the initial pleading sets forth sufficient facts to have it removed. The second one is if the initial pleading does not, when the defendant receives notice by way of another pleading, a motion, or some other order or paper that federal jurisdiction may have obtained, then he has another 30-day period from that date to seek a removal. As part of the second paragraph of 1446, there is an outside one-year period jurisdictional limit, we contend, from the date of the commencement of the pleading. If the defendant is operating under the second part of the 1446 and he does not remove the case within a one-year period, the case must be remanded to state court. We would submit, Your Honor, that under the Romo decision and other decisions cited in our brief, the events occurring in state court prior to removal, state law applies. In the case at bar, the Indiana state procedural law and common law, which has construed it, has indicated that unless a dismissal, whether it be of a case, an action, or a cause of action, unless a dismissal is accompanied by an order or a final judgment, the case remains pending in the state court. It remains pending, active on the state court. Now, admittedly, this is a lot different than federal court. We know in federal court that if there's a dismissal of any kind under Rule 41, you're going to have an order or a judgment of some kind indicating that the case was dismissed. This did not occur in the state court in this case, and we have to apply state law under Romo. I think not only is the law clear under the decisional law, which we cited in our brief, but also under Indiana Trial Rule 77, which makes a distinction when a case is with regard to the status of a case that cases that are pending in a state court. There are two status that a case can have in state court. It is either pending or it is a case that has been decided. Under Rule 77, a decided case is defined as all actions that have been concluded and no other proceedings need to be conducted as evidenced by the final judgment or other court order. There was never a final judgment or other court order in 1993 when this case was...
That's because you voluntarily dismissed the case, and under Indiana law that operates as though it was never filed.
No, it does not. I'm sorry, I beg to differ. There's a line of cases that say that when a case is dismissed or a cause of action is dismissed and it's reinstated under Trial Rule 41F, which is a special rule not known in the federal system, that case may be reinstated. And if it is reinstated, line of cases say it's as though it was never dismissed, and
right.
It takes its place back
yes,
on the docket.
Yes, procedure picks up at the time of reinstatement, but that doesn't mean that it remains in a pending status after you have voluntarily dismissed it.
I beg to differ.
And to get to the more operative point here, you did not provide notice to the defendants in this case of the reinstatement of the case and did not provide notice of any subsequent events in the case for many, many years until you obtained your default,
because
multi-million-dollar default judgment, and sought to execute on it. And that's a violation of not only the rules of procedure but the rules of professional conduct in the state of Indiana.
I beg to differ, Your Honor. The case continued to pend on the court's docket. It's evidenced under separate appendix.
Would you address the notice question, counsel?
The notice question is simple. The case, as long as the case continued to pend and there was no final order, the state court continued to have jurisdiction not only of the case but
now,
of the persons.
You didn't have to serve any of your papers on your adversary?
We served. We served them a summons. They were alerted that there was a case pending against them. When the case was dismissed...
You didn't serve any subsequent papers after the summons? You think that's the Indiana rule?
I think the Indiana rule is if the case is pending, you have to make judicial inquiry yourself. You have to look at the docket.
So your normal practice when you file papers in an Indiana court is not to send copies to your adversary?
Well, my normal practice is if my opponent appears by local counsel, if it's not a state attorney, I'll send papers to the local attorney who has appeared. Nobody appeared in this case for American Cyanamed.
But
the case continued to pend.
You knew they were represented by counsel, and that gives rise to a professional obligation under the rules of professional conduct and the Smith versus Johnston case to provide notice, whether or not the trial rules require it in the absence of an appearance.
Counsel was not admitted in Indiana. Didn't know he was an attorney at the time. For all I, he was a manager of a legal department. I didn't know whether he was an attorney or not. I don't know that Smith versus Johnson even applies in this case.
Is that a reasonable argument to make, counsel, that a manager of a legal department?
I don't know. I don't practice within multi-million-dollar corporations, Your Honor. I don't know what their arrangements are. Certainly, it wouldn't hurt them to just call local counsel and have somebody appear for them, and they didn't do that. Simple phone call.
Why didn't you give notice?
I was under the impression that the rule was as I'm indicating to the court right now.
What did you tell the Indiana State Court when you sought default judgment?
I didn't tell them anything. I filed a motion for default. The court looked at its record. The court indicated that it thought default was appropriate and entered the order.
Did you represent that you had given notice?
No, I did not.
Did the court ask?
I don't recall. I don't know that.
At any point in the proceedings, at the point that default was granted, at the point that the $31 or $32 million damages judgment was entered?
$5 million, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. Different case. We've got another one of these. Another one of these this morning.
Yes, not that good. In fact, the state court took it on its own to try to serve Letterly, which is a co-defendant in this case, and the envelope came back, even though it was served at the same address in which service was obtained.
So nobody inquired or offered any information about whether notice had been provided at any point along the way?
Other than what was stated in the court file, no, I don't recall that.
Well, I'm asking you what was stated in the court file.
The court file showed that there was service of a summons and complaint.
What about notice?
And there was no appearance. That's what the
judgment.
Court file showed.
So there was no reflection in the court file that notice was provided of the default judgment motion
or
subsequent proceedings?
No, Your Honor. No. The cases are clear in Indiana anyway, that once you've been served, the court continues to have jurisdiction over you. And if you have...
This is not a jurisdictional issue.
I go by what the state court law says, and I'm following state court law. If the court wishes not to look at the state court law, that's your prerogative. But state court law says once you acquire jurisdiction, if you don't appear, appearing is one way to protect your interests. And if you don't appear, you better be talking to the clerk periodically to see what's going on, or else you're chargeable with notice in Indiana.
State court law requires you to provide notice to a party that you know is represented before you seek a default judgment. That's what the professional responsibility rules require, and that's what Smith versus Johnston
rules. Rule 55.
Can you address the Smith versus Johnston case?
I haven't addressed it anywhere here. I don't know that I'm prepared, but I just generally recall that. That's a lot different. It was a medical malpractice case in which there was a long involvement and a protracted relationship between the plaintiff's, the patient plaintiff's attorney and the defense attorney, where they took the case all the way to a medical review panel. They had daily exchanges, almost monthly exchanges, on the file, and the court there found that under those circumstances that certainly a courtesy copy would have been required. Nothing like the situation here. A one-time letter from a manager of an out-of-state corporation who ought to have handled the case by hiring an Indiana lawyer, which they did not do. I abided by the request. He wanted it dismissed because, according to what he told me and what he represented in his letter, all claims of this type must be first submitted to the federal vaccination court. This proved to be wrong. Whether they knew it was wrong when they made that representation or not, I do not know. But I followed up before we even dismissed the case. There's an affidavit here in the file. I called the federal vaccination court and was told the very same thing. You got to file your claim with the vaccination court before you do anything else. Based upon that information and based upon an initial reading of the statute, Section 11, which says no person shall maintain an action based upon injuries received from a vaccine covered by this act. And if you have filed a case, you have to dismiss it under the federal statute. I was following the law. But being aware of the problem we have right now, we didn't dismiss it with prejudice. We didn't dismiss it and obtain a court order to conclude the case forever. No, we did what Indiana law permits. We dismissed it without prejudice, pending compliance with then-known statutory conditions precedent. This is done all the time in Indiana. Subject to reinstatement under Rule 41F. The case was not over. They knew the case was not over, or any good Indiana attorney would have known the case was not over when the cause of action was dismissed. And by the way, there is a distinction in Indiana, too, between a cause and a cause of action. We've pointed that out in our brief. Cause of action is a theory of the case. We dismissed the theory of the case. We didn't dismiss the cause. We didn't dismiss the case. The case continued to depend on the state court's docket. That's Indiana state court law. And this court.
What sense did that make? Did you dismiss the theory of the case, but you didn't dismiss the case?
Subject to reinstatement.
Never heard of that before.
Subject to reinstatement. Analogous situation, 12b-6. What happens when you fail to state a claim upon which relief can be granted? Court says you fail to state a claim upon which relief may be granted. Cause of claim dismissed. That doesn't end the cause of action under 12b-6.
Well, it does, counsel, if there's nothing else in the case.
If nothing else is filed, yes.
But you only filed one cause of action, and you dismissed it.
Between the period of time under a 12b-6, between the period of time that a court finds that a claim has not stated a cause of action, I had a red light. I guess am I beyond 10 minutes already?
Your time has expired, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Yorgis.
Your Honors, my name is Roger Yorgis. I'm with the firm of Wilmer, Cutler, Pickering, Hale, and Dorr from Washington, D.C., representing the appellees in this case. I inquired of a much more experienced appellate advocate in my firm about what I ought to do when I have nothing to say. And he said, say nothing. But I can't do that. My client's here in the courtroom.
Lawyers always follow John W. Davis's rule number 10 of oral argument. You do know what rule number 10 is.
I don't know what rule number 10 is.
It's very short. Sit down.
Sit down. Right. Well, I think our briefs on this in this case actually do address all the issues which are relevant to this court's consideration. I really only have 2 points. To accept the plaintiff's interpretation of the Indiana rules would be to assume that common sense, common courtesy, and due process have fallen into desuetude in Indiana. That hasn't happened. And secondly, the notion that a party could come into federal court, a party who has failed to give notice in violation of the Constitution and in patent violation of ethical obligations, and argue that a single time period that operates in this case, whether it's the 30-day removal period, whether it's the statute of limitations, whether it's the default judgment, should not be applied by this court, I think is, and there's no other word for it, preposterous. And unless the court has any other questions, I would submit on the briefs.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.